I'm Bob Garfield, and this is an OTM podcast extra, this time from our friends at the data news site 538.com. As Election Day inches closer, 538 decided to look at a race featuring an unorthodox billionaire wearing his political outsiderness as a badge of honor. This was 1992, and that man was Ross Perot, and his campaign against Democrat Bill Clinton and Republican George H.W. Bush still stands as a cautionary tale about, well, it depends on who you ask.
Ross Perot absolutely cost George H.W. Bush re-election in 92.
The idea that Perot cost Bush re-election in 1992 is supported by everything but evidence.
I don't care what the Clinton people say. They are only saying that because they want to say President Clinton won outright, but he did not have a majority mandate.
There are people that are going to go to their grave believing the earth is 6,000 years old. All that I can do is say what the evidence is.
That's James Carville.
I was chief strategist for the 1992 Bill Clinton presidential campaign.
And Mary Madeline.
I was George Herbert Walker Bush's deputy campaign manager in 1992.
They're married and actually dated while working on opposite sides of the 1992 presidential election. Him for Clinton, her for Bush.
It's an election that still divides people today. Not so much because of Clinton or Bush, but because of the other guy, Ross Perot.
Now, before I start, I have to use my voodoo stick again. And this is a simulated alligator claw on a voodoo stick.
This is the third installment in 538's series of audio documentaries made in collaboration with ESPN Films, re-examining what we know about past campaigns. The time has come to talk about Ross Perot. My name is Jody Avergan.
And I'm Galen Druk. Some people, like Mary Madeline, insist the third-party candidate, a former Republican, spoiled the election for incumbent president George H.W. Bush. Others argue that Bill Clinton won it on his own merits. That Perot, who got 19% of the popular vote, took votes evenly from both sides.
We talked to people involved in all three campaigns, pollsters and researchers, and dug through the archives to get a picture of what the campaign looked like and why it turned out the way it did. Galen took the lead on reporting the story. Galen, take it away.
1992. It's the year Whitney Houston's Bodyguard album became the best-selling soundtrack of all time. The country's largest mall, Mall of America, opened in Bloomington, Minnesota. Mall of America. The American economy was also in the pits.
Welcome to the world, class of 92, and good luck finding a job. Waiting for them just off campus, the toughest job market in two decades.
Well, I think it was a time when people were really scared. They were scared of their jobs. They were scared of the changes that were going on in the economy.
Fred Malik was the campaign manager for the George Bush 1992 re-election run.
They were seeing some well-established institutions going bankrupt, and I think they were concerned for their future.
While the candidates for the Democratic nomination were preparing to face off in Iowa and New Hampshire in early 92, President Bush was fielding questions like this.
If you ask them now, are you economically better off than you were 3 years ago? Do you think many people would say yes?
Today, no. If you said economically, because I think there is a lack of confidence out there across this country.
Abroad, however, Bush had scored what was seen as a big and easy victory.
Jubilation in Kuwait City after 7 months of Iraqi occupation. And U.S. forces have cut off all escape for Iraqi troops as Saddam Hussein comes up with still another offer.
He had been the president, of course, who had taken the United States into Kuwait to take the Iraqis out. It was quite a heroic expedition and successful expedition. And as we moved into the spring of 91, he was riding very high with an 80% plus approval rating.
Very dramatic developments tonight that indicate this war finally is coming rapidly to a close.
Bush's approval rating peaked at 89% after the Gulf War in 1991. No surprise, his team decided to make it the focus of his campaign.
If I'd have listened to the leader of the United States Senate, George Mitchell, Saddam Hussein would be in Saudi Arabia and you'd be paying $20 a gallon for gasoline. Now try that one on for size.
He was very confident about re-election.
I'm getting sick and tired. I am every single night hearing one of these carping little liberal Democrats jumping all over my you-know-what.
The overarching strategy was to emphasize the success of the Bush presidency. We had hit a recession, but you always do hit that in the cycle. We were coming out of it just fine.
On the other side of the race was this man.
Tonight, we want to put the forces of the status quo and short-term greed on notice. The party's over. We're in for a change. We want our country back.
He had it. He was so natural. He was so charismatic. He also played to our worst vulnerability, which was generational.
Not long ago, George Bush said he'd do whatever it takes to get elected. And Bill Clinton, he may meet his match.
That said,
do you have any comments about the allegations from Jennifer Flowers?
Long-rumored allegations of marital infidelity finally surfaced in a supermarket tabloid. Since then, for better or for worse, Governor Clinton's private life has become the overriding issue in the Democratic presidential campaign.
We thought, look, he's got a good, consistent message on the economy. It's the economy, stupid, was a smart thing. But based on his personal character, as evidenced by the series of eruptions with women, that the American people probably are not going to go in that direction.
So on one hand, we have a recession-riddled, but once very popular wartime president. And on the other, a young, charismatic governor now enveloped in a scandal. And in walks this guy.
I grew up in Texarkana, Texas, 5 blocks from the Arkansas border.
Ross Perot.
Now, before I start, I have to use my voodoo stick again.
He was slim and about 5'5", with short cropped hair. At the time, he was 62, and he came from Texarkana, the place where Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana all meet. And he'd address the country holding a black pointer he called his voodoo stick.
And this is a simulated alligator claw on a voodoo stick. So it reminds me of my first trip to Arkansas, where one of the things you could go see, this was before Disneyland, you could go see the alligators.
His entry was absolutely preposterous. He was a caricature of a crazy person, actually.
A billionaire who made his money in tech, some data processing system that, suffice it to say, got him super rich and earned him a name in Texas.
All these guys in Texas knew each other, and former Texas Governor John Connally, he would call me every now and then, and I talked to him as quite a character and was trying to figure, you know, Perot out. And James, you got to understand, Ross just stone-ass crazy. You can't figure him out.
Ross Perot had an everyman touch for someone who was a multi-billionaire. I mean, he was one of the richest Americans at the time. His business, Perot Systems, was so incredibly successful.
That's Frank Luntz, the guy from the TV news focus groups. At the time, he ran internal polling for the Perot campaign. But that wasn't his title.
I was the director of research. And the reason why is that he told reporters that he didn't believe in polling or focus groups. Research was okay, but polling wasn't. And so I was director of research. Perot was a down homespun kind of aw shucks guy who just happens to own a cigarette boat that goes 180 miles an hour and a helicopter that goes 180 miles an hour. So before he'd come into the campaign headquarters, on occasion, he and his son would race the helicopter and the boat. I mean, who does that? Except Ross Perot.
Ross Perot wandered into the race, seemingly by accident, during an interview on Larry King in late February of 92.
Is there any scenario in which you would run for president?
Well, number one, I don't want to.
I know, but is
number
there a scenario?
Two, you know, if you're that serious, you, the people, are that serious, you register me in 50 states. And if you're not willing to organize and do that, then this is all just talk.
Wait, Larry. Are you
I'm saying to the ordinary folks, if you're dead serious,
start
then
committees
I want
Florida,
to see
Georgia.
Some sweat.
Basically, he said no, but maybe, and show me that you really mean it.
The notion that you could just get a bunch of strangers to the process to get you on the ballot just seemed unfathomable to us.
Lo and behold, just a month later.
Now he says he'll spend $50 to $100 million of his own money to run for president if enough ordinary Americans sign petitions to put his name on the ballot in all 50 states. Perot's name already is on the ballot in Tennessee, and this weekend voters in Texas signed petitions to get him on the ballot there.
We thought his, I'm funding my own campaign, I'm beholden to nobody, I'm a rich guy, we thought that would be very discordant to Americans. And when we polled it, after running around making fun of it, it turned out that people trusted him more precisely because of his own personal wealth.
He had that thing every politician wants, the outsider appeal.
He would talk like politicians didn't talk before.
And plain Texas talk, it's time to take out the trash and clean out the barn or it's going to be too late.
And, you know, a lot of his appeal when you would do focus groups, he was not a typical politician, really shake things up in Washington kind of appeal.
If you want your car fixed, you go get a first-class mechanic. You don't get, you know, somebody selling aluminum siding. Now, that's Washington right now, and that's the reason none of these problems get addressed. They just don't know what to do.
Ross Perot, who'd never held elected office, could credibly critique the political class during a time when, according to ABC,
an overwhelming majority, 79%, say they are dissatisfied or just plain angry about the way the federal government works.
By April, 2 months after his Larry King appearance, he was polling in third, 4 points behind Bill Clinton, the Democratic frontrunner.
Our ABC News poll shows that, as of now, Perot would garner 24% of the vote in a three-way race with Bush and Clinton. And tens of thousands of volunteers have turned out in meetings like this one in Charlottesville, Virginia, to work for Perot.
We're going to send a message to Washington, aren't we, that we're fed up, we're mad as hell, and we've had enough, right?
He didn't just have the outsider appeal, either. He also had an economic message that resonated.
The message is the deficit and the debt are destroying America, that your kids are getting screwed. And he's the guy who's going to do something about it.
Here's the picture on our country's debt. Look at how it's grown over the years. That is a staggering load for our country. Folks in Washington financed long-term problems, short-term, to keep the interest rates down. That's suicide in business. That's suicide in your personal life. That's suicide in your government.
So he had his outsider status and an economic message. The only thing missing? A media strategy. And lucky for his campaign, he loved the television cameras.
It's hard for people to remember today, 1992, being the last of the normal media campaigns where they were driven by not the 24/7 cycle, but the network news, with the possible exception of Larry King. So a favorite format for Ross Perot was to go on Larry King.
Perot was an early darling of cable news election coverage. And he didn't just do TV interviews either.
30-minute ads. 30-minute infomercials with the most boring charts that looked like television from the 1950s.
One of the things he's best remembered for are these ads, where, of course, he used his voodoo stick.
Tonight, Ross Perot, plain talk about jobs, debt, and the Washington mess.
He would buy 30-minute blocks of network airtime, sit down with a stack of charts, and talk. His first ad attracted 16.5 million viewers.
Good evening. We've talked a lot about the importance of having the American people fully informed so that they can make intelligent decisions as owners of this country. In effect, this is our first town hall.
He was so connective on TV because he was usually, the man could stay on message. He had a message and he could stay on message.
And Ross Perot didn't just put out one of these infomercials. He had a whole collection, including Ross Perot on balancing the budget and reforming government, Ross Perot on how to build a business and create jobs, an hour-long biography on Ross Perot, part one, the early years, and part two, business success and leadership. And of course,
Chicken Feathers, Deep Voodoo, and the American Dream.
And these infomercials weren't just an ego trip. They were part of a plan.
You could not jam Ross Perot into a traditional 30-second spot. You needed something bigger.
Again, Frank Luntz, Perot's internal pollster.
I'll tell you the story.
Tell it, Frank.
We were finally allowed to go do research in early June. So I'd been on since April, maybe the end of March, beginning of April. And finally, in early June, they said, go out, do dial sessions, see how people react, and let me know what you find.
Basically, figure out how to sell Ross Perot to Americans.
We had, at the time, VHS tapes. And there are three different tapes. One is Ross Perot speaking to an audience when he uses all those really weird phrases, like the ant in the attic and the check under the hood and all those things he used to say. The second tape were endorsements of him. And the third tape was a biography of him. The normal way that we would show it is that we would begin with the biography, then we would have the endorsements, and then we'd show him speaking.
But Luntz was traveling on the road, and after one stop, he forgot to rewind the VHS tapes. So in the next city, the order was mixed up.
When we got to Colorado, we showed him speaking first, then we did the endorsements, and then we did his bio. And if you don't know his background, but you hear him speak, you think he's a little off, a little weird.
People in that focus group didn't respond the same way as previous groups. So in the next session, he switched the tapes back to the original order. The biography, then Perot himself, and then the endorsements. And
you could not tear people away. Once they supported Perot, you could not move them. That presentation in that order, no matter what negative information I gave them afterward, they were unmovable.
Tell people first and foremost that Perot is a down-home, self-made businessman, and they'll be on board with the rest.
And it just blew me away. And from that point on, I knew how he needed to be introduced to the American people, which was the beginning of them deciding that they're going to do communications that aren't 30 seconds long. They're going to be a minute, 2 minutes, even half an hour.
Good morning. Ross Perot, Texas billionaire, undeclared candidate for president, our special guest here to take your calls today, Thursday, June the 11th, 1992.
By the beginning of June, Ross Perot was polling ahead of both Bush and Clinton with 39% of the vote.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to today on what figures to be a very interesting morning. We are joined, as noted, by Ross Perot, who, if you believe most polls, will be a very formidable candidate for president.
All of a sudden, the next thing you know, he's running first. We're running third.
In the span of 4 months, Perot had gone from musing about running for president on Larry King to leading the two major party candidates. But as he climbed in the polls, the same media attention that had hyped his campaign turned increasingly critical. Here's Peter Elkind of the Dallas Observer talking to ABC in 1992.
Now it's more important than ever, obviously, to look into his past, to look into what he's done. Because while he says what you see is what you get, there's a lot in his history that offers contradictory signals.
In late June, the Washington Post reported that Perot had hired a private investigator in the 80s to try to uncover damaging information about the family of George Bush, who was then vice president to Ronald Reagan.
Let me put it this way. If he was having my children investigated, that is beyond the pale. Leave my kids alone, I'd say. They're good, honest boys and a daughter. Good, honest girl.
Perot continued to attract criticism into July. At an NAACP event, he referred to the black audience as, quote, you people. This added to previous missteps, like when he told Barbara Walters on 2020 that he wouldn't appoint gays to his cabinet in order to avoid controversy. As the pressure mounted, conflict arose within his campaign.
In the office, there was a little bit of intrigue, but it was more about the challenge of managing Ross Perot.
He ignored his staff's advice and chose to deliver his own speeches over the ones written by consultants. Staffers began to leak to the press.
There are only four people he talked to. Perot would have these meetings with those four people. And within 24 hours, it would appear in the Wall Street Journal. And he would be apoplectic. They could not stop leaking.
According to polls just out tonight, Ross Perot's undeclared candidacy
seems to be losing some of its steam recently. In today's poll, Bush leads with 35%. Perot has slipped 5 points behind, and Clinton a close third. This poll was the first to put Perot in the lead. That was just 1 month ago.
Day after day, Perot continued to slide further down in the polls.
So at that time, we, as everyone else did, thought it was somewhat of a political version of a Roman candle, if you will. He kind of shot up, flamed, and there it was.
But that didn't quite happen either.
From the ABC News Election Night Command Center in New York, this is the 92 Vote. Once again, David Brinkley and Peter Jennings.
We're going to make another projection now. We project that Bill Clinton is going to be the next president of the United States. We project that Ohio has gone for Governor Clinton. Let's take a look at the big board.
On election night, I remember not being that surprised by the results, thinking actually it was a little closer than I expected.
Bill Kristol, chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle.
I think it ended up being about a five-point race, but being surprised by Perot's numbers. You know, Perot was running, as I recall, around 10, 12% in the polls about a week before Election Day, and he ends up with 19%.
19% of the vote. Almost one in five Americans voted for him.
Starting last February, you did something that everybody said couldn't be done. Millions of you came together to take your country back.
It was the best performance by a third-party candidate since 1912, back when Teddy Roosevelt ran with the Progressive Party after having already served two terms in office.
He gave Washington a laser-like message to listen to the people.
So, we arrive where we began.
Unequivocally, to my grave, Ross Perot cost George H.W. Bush's re-election in 1992.
A former Republican with a conservative economic message wins almost 20% of the vote, leaving neither major party candidate with a majority.
President-elect Clinton got 43% of the vote. It was hard to see him getting past 43%, maybe 44%, but that remaining vote from 43 to 50% plus one was not going to Bill Clinton.
And the theory of Ross Perot spoiling the election for George H.W. Bush is born. Here's the plan. We're going to check out this theory from a few perspectives. Let's start with the man who did Perot's internal polling.
Perot had me do a survey late in the campaign to test a number of different items.
One of the questions was, if voting for Perot were not an option, who would you vote for?
And it was 52 Bill Clinton, 48 George Bush.
The campaign's internal numbers showed that it was an even split, and external numbers backed that up.
Exit polls asked people, who would your second choice have been if Perot weren't running?
Nate Silver, editor-in-chief of 538.
And it split about evenly between Bush and Clinton.
Official exit polls asked that question on Election Day itself. The day after the election, the New York Times cited those polls, writing, quote, the impact of Mr. Perot's supporters on the campaign's outcome appears to have been minimal.
By the way, if Bush had won 60% of the Perot vote, you can do the math, he still would have lost the Electoral College by a pretty good margin.
So both internal and external polls pretty much agreed. But there's also further evidence to suggest Perot was not a spoiler.
We had this kind of natural experiment because Perot dropped out of the campaign for a big chunk of the race.
Sorry, we never got to that part. Ross Perot actually dropped out of the race in the middle of July after his numbers in the polls began to slip.
Throughout this effort, we have said repeatedly that our objective is to improve our country, not disrupt the political process.
Basically, he said, if he were to run, probably none of the three candidates would get 270 electoral votes, meaning the election would be decided in the House of Representatives. And Perot said, that would be bad for the country.
So therefore, I will not become a candidate.
For the record, there's little to suggest he would have forced the election to the House. Even with 20% of the popular vote, he didn't get a single electoral vote. But then, on October 1st, just a month and 3 days before the election,
the 62-year-old billionaire raced across the American political landscape like a Texas tornado last summer before dropping out. But He kept paying for a Perot organization, and today he cashed in.
The volunteers in all 50 states have asked me to run as a candidate for President of the United States. Jim Stockdale, our vice presidential candidate, and I are honored to accept their request.
Ross Perot was Election 92's October surprise. He got back in the race after being on the sidelines for 2.5 months. The whole episode boosted the narrative that Perot was
just stone-ass crazy. You can't figure him out.
But it also gives us a 2.5-month window into what the race would have looked like without Ross Perot in it. And what happened when he dropped out?
During that period, Clinton's lead was actually larger over Bush in the polls, not smaller. He was leading by 15, 20 points at one point.
Bush had been polling ahead of Clinton before Perot dropped out. After he exited, Clinton shot up to the mid-50s, while Bush remained in the mid-30s. And the polls remained about there until Perot got back in the race in October.
The idea that Perot cost Bush re-election in 1992 is supported by everything but evidence. If ever vote he took from them, he took one from us.
That's the argument for Perot not spoiling the election for Bush. And it has been studied by political scientists. And they've arrived at the same conclusion. Perot's support split equally both ways.
But I think that understates the importance of Perot in damaging Bush, in the dynamics of the campaign.
Again, Bill Kristol, who was working for Vice President Dan Quayle.
Perot, a traditional Republican, someone who was very associated with the Reagan and Bush administrations, a businessman, a vet, and all the things that connote to voters out there, a legitimate Republican conservative. When Perot takes on Bush, I think it affected the dynamic of the campaign. It weakened Bush much more than Clinton.
Kristol makes a point that's hard to quantify. Sure, on Election Day itself, Perot's support may have split 50-50. But throughout the campaign, Perot hurt Bush more than he hurt Clinton. Bush's deputy campaign manager, Mary Madeline, agrees.
Ross Perot's presence gave Clinton running room that he wouldn't otherwise have. And the attacks that Ross Perot made on Bush hurt Bush more than Clinton could have because Ross Perot had credibility on those issues and Bill Clinton didn't. Every event that we found ourselves in, particularly the debates with him, caused President Bush to underperform.
Perot didn't hold back in the debates. Here he is in the first one. Also the first presidential debate to include three candidates.
I don't like to see the country's principles violated. I don't like to see the people in a deteriorating economy and a deteriorating country because our government has lost touch with the people. When you go to bed tonight, look at your children, think of their dreams, and ask yourself, isn't it time to stop talking about it? Isn't it time to do it?
Another example of Perot hurting Bush is the way Perot dropped out of the race. Even Frank Luntz agrees.
Perot, if he wanted to defeat George Bush, could not have dropped out at a better moment than when he did.
Perot backed out of the race literally hours before Bill Clinton took the stage at the Democratic convention to accept the nomination.
My fellow delegates and my fellow Americans.
He pulls out. All of a sudden, all the Perot people are like, what do I do now? And Bill Clinton takes the stage, delivers a very remarkable convention speech. And Perot numbers collapse, and all these people move to Bill Clinton.
I still believe in a place called hope. God bless you, and God bless America.
You could not go from Bush to Clinton. It was impossible. The differences were too great, not just in issues, but in the persona of the people. But you could go from Bush to Perot, and Perot to Clinton. So Perot became a stopping point, and at the moment that Perot pulls out, the Bush people are insulting him. At the very moment all these Perot voters, 22-23%, are deciding what to do, the Republicans, the official Republicans, are trashing him. And all these Perot people said, you know what? I'm not sure about Bill Clinton, but I hate these Republicans. And they all moved over to Clinton. And you watch this surge. It was one of the biggest convention bounces of modern times.
To be fair, Perot didn't only disadvantage Bush. He also attacked Clinton's record as governor of Arkansas. And from a strategic point of view, voters looking for a change in rough economic times had both Perot and Clinton to choose from instead of just Clinton. But let's try to tease this out one more way. Let's put Perot aside for a moment. Without him in the race, were there reasons to expect a Clinton victory?
For one thing, President Bush was extremely unpopular. He had an approval rating in the 30s. Then you had a recession. It wasn't the most severe recession, but a recession usually hurts the incumbent party. You'd have the same party in charge for many years.
There was also this.
Read my lips.
George Herbert Walker Bush said in the 1988 convention, read my lips, no new taxes. And that's as blunt and as direct and as tough as you can be. And then he goes and breaks it.
2 years after Read My Lips, Bush signed a budget that raised taxes. Some Republicans were upset enough to back a challenger, Pat Buchanan, in the primaries. Bush was struggling.
We started that campaign with a 91% approval rating. And there were those that thought that 91% approval rating, which was the legacy of the first Gulf War, was somehow static and permanent. And it was quite the opposite. It was fleeting. It was ephemeral. It was irrelevant.
Bush faced campaign hurdles that would have been there with or without Perot. And on top of that, Clinton did have some things going for him.
Clinton obviously is one of, along with Reagan and maybe Obama, is kind of one of the most skilled politicians of the past 40 years. He's a guy who, number one, is really persuasive. He got one of the biggest convention bounces, we call it, of all time when he introduced himself with Al Gore to the public. Number two, Clinton was running as a new quote-unquote Democrat. He's running on welfare reform. He's running on free enterprise, and he's a Southerner, and he understands how to relate to people in different parts of the country, not just the Northeast.
In the same year George Bush made headlines for being unfamiliar with a modern grocery store scanner, Bill Clinton and Al Gore were, well...
Clinton got more than a running mate. He found a jogging partner. The youth team was out today looking for votes wherever they could find them.
Jogging around Little Rock, talking to folks in minivans with TV crews in tow.
The strategy is to play up the fact that this is the youngest ticket ever to run for national office.
Everybody remembers it's the economy, stupid, but what their other message was change, not more of the same, change. It's time for a change. James Carville famously said, and I'll never forgive him for it, when I look at George H.W. Bush, I think of last year's calendar.
After 12 years of the same party, amid a recession, a young challenger selling a new kind of politics entered the scene. And he won. It's not shocking. Here's President Bush's campaign manager, Fred Malik.
I wanted to believe that we would have won without Ross Perot. It would have been convenient to believe that and blame it all on that.
After all, that is what Bush's deputy campaign manager, Mary Madeline, believes.
Unequivocally, to my grave.
But after the election, Malik checked it out for himself.
Everything we could see, all the polling we did, would suggest that we lost the election ourselves because we failed to address the economic concerns of the American people. That even without Perot in the race, we probably would have lost it. That's what I believe.
So Perot probably didn't affect the outcome of the 92 race in the way that some people claim. But there's more to be learned from that election.
I mean, what does Ross Perot's experience prove? In a sense, it's a guy who ran and then dropped out and got back in the race 4 weeks out with no real campaign structure at all, got himself into the debates and surged at the end to 19%. That's a lot of votes.
A guy who pulled out and said, I don't want to run anymore, and went away and then changed his mind. One out of five Americans voted for him. That's remarkable.
By most measures of political wisdom, Ross Perot had a lot of faults. But he also tapped into something powerful.
By golly, you're taking your country back!
Everyone thinks campaigns go one election stop. They do not. They're on a continuum. And if you really look at what the attraction to Perot was, you can see the embryonic state of what the attraction to Trump is today.
My pledge reads, I'm with you, the American people. I am your voice.
If Donald Trump is the kind of Jesus of the disenchanted, displaced, non-college white voter, then Perot was the John the Baptist of that sort of movement.
Now, it's hard to say anyone is quite like Donald Trump.
The difference between Perot and Trump is that Perot didn't go off on every different tangent. Perot did not start attacking Gold Star moms. Perot wasn't telling Second Amendment advocates to take justice into their own hands. Ross Perot was much more optimistic, much more positive in his approach. Donald Trump is always on the attack.
But it's also difficult to deny the similarities.
In my head, they blur because there were similarities between them in the simplicity of the message and how powerful it resonated with so many people.
They're political outsiders, successful businessmen, charismatic populists. They tell it like it is and focus on a simple message. This thing or that thing is destroying America. The policy details are secondary.
I don't have a written position paper on every little thing anybody wants to know about. Give me a little time and I will.
Look, anything I say right now, I'm not the president. Everything's a suggestion. No matter what you say, it's a suggestion.
And their faults could be forgiven.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
It didn't matter if journalists doubted their intentions.
Mr. Perot, a slightly different question. Not do you want to run for president, but do you want to be president?
Or if they dabbled in conspiracy.
Perot even was suspicious of his own former campaign manager.
He accused me at one point in time of being a plant from the White House.
I'm afraid the election's going to be rigged, I have to be honest.
Or if people on their own teams spoke out against them, like Ross Perot's former economic advisor.
Ross withdrawing as he did and when he did raises doubts in anybody's mind about his temperament for being president.
No matter how many norms they broke, the attraction was there.
You know, there are millions of crazy people in this country. I don't know what we're going to do about it. See, I've got a theme song for our campaign, and here it comes. Just listen to it.
We're crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely.
Until the 2016 election, it's been easy to file Ross Perot away as an anomaly or incorrectly as a spoiler. But both of those now seem insufficient.
The fact that 19 million people voted for him was a kind of a sign, though, I think, of the degree of dissatisfaction with the political class that had produced Bush and Clinton. In a way, maybe a bit of a harbinger for the next quarter century when that dissatisfaction popped up in all kinds of ways and maybe grew over those 25 years or so.
And given that, maybe it's even worth asking why Ross Perot didn't actually end up doing better than he did.
Well, what it demonstrated to me is that in spite of a strong effort in really striking a chord with a broad segment of the American people, that it's very difficult for a third-party candidate to succeed.
And this is a big lesson from Perot's campaign.
Even though Americans say that they're not partisan, they still have a home. They still start by being a Republican or a Democrat, and then they move based on the candidates or the environment of that election.
Perot waged his campaign outside the two-party system. He got 19 million votes, but not a single electoral vote. But Donald Trump has waged his campaign from within. He got 13 million votes in the Republican primary, enough for a victory, and enough to put him within striking distance of the White House.
I am with you. I will fight for you. And I will win for you.
The question people always ask about Ross Perot is, how would the election have been different in 92 if he didn't run? But the more interesting question is, how would the outcome have been different if he ran as a major party candidate?
Thank you.
At this point, odds are Donald Trump will come short of winning the election. But like Perot, he'll leave behind lessons to be learned by the next charismatic populist. And just as Donald Trump did better than Perot, maybe the next charismatic populist will do better than Donald Trump.
This documentary was reported and produced by Galen Druk and edited by Jody Avergan. The 538 and ESPN team have two other election audio documentaries we recommend. One about Howard Dean and the other about Barack Obama and the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And as the nation counts down till November 8th, the politics team at 538 is now producing podcasts daily. You can find them and more at 538.com/podcasts or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Bob Garfield, and this has been an OTM Podcast Extra.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.